Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I'm thrilled to be doing another keyword episode with the only one and only, yes, the only one and only, Dr. Tim Kaiz-Tora. Did I say it right, Tim, this time?
Nailed it.
Nice. All right. For folks who maybe didn't catch when this happened before, I realized that for years I'd been mispronouncing Tim's name, and he never told me, but he finally told me, and I'm glad he did. I think of this as like the broccoli in the teeth, you know, like if you don't tell someone, then they'll never know, and I'm glad Tim finally told me, and it's impressive that he did it after all those years. So thanks, Tim, for clarifying that. So Dr. Tim Kaiz-Tora, and we are here to do another keyword episode. We are going to cover respiratory anatomy and pharmacology. This is really commonly tested, so very high yield, and I'm excited to do it. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me again. Today we'll cover respiratory anatomy and pharmacology. It's in the basic topics portion of the ABA outline. It falls under organ-based basic and clinical sciences, appropriately named respiratory system. Part A of that little section is physiology, and we won't cover that today. That's the portion that includes things like volumes, mechanics, ventilation and perfusion, diffusion, blood gases, control of ventilation, non-respiratory lung functions, and perioperative smoking specifically. And I'm not saying that these aren't important or that they're less heavily tested, just that we won't be reviewing them here today. And as a caveat and general warning, for all of these episodes, we try to focus more on what's tested, maybe than what's necessarily clinically relevant when those two things don't line up. And we can't cover everything in these sessions. So I do try to go through question banks, go to textbooks, and pick up the things that I see most often. But certainly other things could end up on your test that we don't cover today. Okay, so let's start by covering Section B of the respiratory system, which is anatomy. They want us to know about 1, the nose, 2, the pharynx with its subdivisions and innervations, 3, the larynx with A, its innervation, muscles, blood supply, and cartilages, B, the vocal cords and their positions with paralysis, C, differences between infant and adult, 4, the tracheobronchial tree and its structure and relationships in the neck and the chest, and then 5, the muscles of respiration, including the accessory muscles. Is there anything you want to mention before we get into the key concepts in this section?
No, I think this stuff is tested all the time. As we said, certainly things, for example, like what innervates what when you're doing an awake intubation, I mean, that comes up all the time. So definitely keep this stuff in mind.
All right. So we'll work sort of top down. Key concept 1, we'll start with the nose, which is one of 2 openings to the human airway. It connects to the nasopharynx posteriorly and the nares anteriorly and contains the nasal turbinates, which increase airway surface area, which aids in humidification and warming of inspired air, which is one of the major functions of the nose. Treatment with vasoconstrictors can decrease the size of those blood vessels in that tissue, reducing the risk of bleeding and increasing the diameter for intubation. And then the nose is innervated by the trigeminal nerve, mostly V1 and V2. Moving a little bit further back, key concept 2, the pharynx is a posterior airway structure that extends from the base of the skull to the level of the vocal cords. It's divided into the nasopharynx, which opens into the nose anteriorly, the oropharynx, which opens into the mouth, and the hypo or laryngopharynx. Those are interchangeable. The nasopharynx and oropharynx are separated by the soft palate, while the oropharynx and the hypopharynx are separated by the epiglottis. And Jed, you and I were talking earlier that some places will also list the hyoid bone as the separation between the oropharynx and the hypopharynx. You'll see it written differently in different texts. I would be shocked if they ever tested The epiglottis versus the hyoid bone, or anything that specific, sort of in this anatomy. Different textbooks will sort of treat this differently.
Totally agree. Yeah, I think if you remember both, you're going to have to know both, because they could ask it one way or the other, but you'll never be asked to choose between those two.
All right, and then to wrap up this little section, key concept three is going to be the rest of the sort of sensory innervation. The sensory aspects of the upper airway are all innervated by cranial nerves. So as mentioned above, the nose is innervated by V1 and V2. V1 does the anterior portion, V2 the posterior. The glossopharyngeal nerve, which is cranial nerve 9, innervates the roof of the pharynx, the tonsils, the undersurface of the soft palate, as well as the posterior third of the tongue. The anterior third of the tongue is the trigeminal V3 branch, or 5-3. And below the epiglottis, the sensory innervation is from the cranial nerve vagus. And we'll talk a little bit more about the split of the vagus, but why don't we jump into some questions at this point?
Let's do it.
Number one, while performing general anesthesia with a natural airway, your patient obstructs and you perform a jaw thrust to relieve the obstruction. The success of this maneuver relies on A, the genioglossus muscle, B, the superior laryngeal nerve, or C, the epiglottis.
Yeah, and so hopefully you can get here that if you're doing a jaw thrust, it's a mechanical maneuver. You're not dealing with nerves here. And the epiglottis is really not something you can manipulate from the outside. So just thinking through it, hopefully you can get that the genioglossus muscle is what you're having an influence on as you lift that jaw, and hopefully pulling that tongue away from the back of the throat, which is going to allow air to pass.
That's exactly it. Number two, which of the following is an absolute contraindication to awake fiber optic nasal intubation? A, ongoing prophylactic anticoagulation, B, nasal polyps, or C, skull-based fracture?
Now, hopefully you have in your mind that you don't want to really put anything through the nose, whether that's an NG tube or a fiber optic bronchoscope when there's a skull-based fracture. So this is something maybe you can just get right away. But those other ones, you know, you need to be careful in the setting of anticoagulation, but, you know, you can put a scope through the nose if it's indicated, risk benefits. And then nasal polyps, of course, can make it more difficult, but not an absolute contraindication.
And I agree here. And I think some Texan guidelines do call severe coagulopathy a contraindication to nasal fiber optic. So the key word here is prophylactic anticoagulation. Again, like you said, everything's a risk benefit. But if you have something like therapeutic anticoagulation or just a severe coagulopathy, I'd be careful with that as well.
Yeah, I agree.
And then number three, which is accurate concerning the upper airway? A, the oropharynx is bounded by the soft palate and glottis. B, the trachea has cartilaginous rings anteriorly and is membranous posteriorly. And C, the hypothorax is bounded cephalad by the epiglottis.
So very tricky question here, because while answer choice B is correct in itself, that is a true statement. The trachea has cartilaginous rings anteriorly and is membranous posteriorly. But that is not part of the upper airway. And the question is asking specifically about the upper airway. And so as we discussed earlier, the hypopharynx is bounded cephalad by the epiglottis, or you may see it said the hyoid bone. Either one of those would be correct. And the oropharynx is bounded by the soft palate and glottis. Choice A is also incorrect.
Agreed. And this is just, a good time to pause for a second and just talk about test-taking skill. We've talked about before, if you can read the question and answer it before you read the answer choices, that's best. There's no way you're going to read the question, which is accurate concerning the upper airway, and be able to guess the correct answer, because there's so many things that could fit it. But just because you see something that seems right, don't stop reading the answer choices. There could be something that's a better answer further down.
Yeah, I think that's key. And by the way, the choice A here, the reason it's wrong is because it is bounded by the soft palate and the epiglottis, not the glottis.
Correct. So continuing our discussion of innervation a little further, and we spend a lot of time on this because it's truly tested so much. I get the feeling, and I know this can't be true, that every single test, whether a practice test or the basic, the ITE, all of them had numerous questions about innervation in this area. Key concept four, the vagus nerves gives rise to two important laryngeal innervating nerves, the superior laryngeal nerve and the recurrent laryngeal nerve. The superior laryngeal nerve further divides into an external branch and internal branch. The external branch is motor, while the internal nerve is sensory and supplies the larynx between the epiglottis and the vocal cords. I always remember this as SIME, by the way, sensory, internal, motor, or external, SIME. And then the recurrent laryngeal nerve innervates the larynx below the vocal cords as well as the trachea. So here you need to remember which are sensory. That's recurrent laryngeal and the internal branch of the superior. And then remember that it is the vocal cords that is the part where it changes which one innervates. Superior above, which makes sense, and recurrent below. Key concept 5, the muscles of the larynx are innervated by the recurrent laryngeal nerve with only one exception, and that's the cricothyroid muscle, which is innervated by the external branch of the superior laryngeal nerve. That muscle tenses the vocal cords. And then the posterior cricoarytenoid muscles abduct the vocal cords, and the lateral cricoarytenoid muscles adduct the vocal cords. Both of those are recurrent laryngeal nerve innervated. And a frequently tested topic is what happens to vocal cords when innervation is disrupted. And we've talked about this some previously. For instance, recurrent laryngeal nerve injury is often tested in the setting of thyroid or parathyroid surgery. So I'd sort of like to spell this stuff out as well. That'll bring us to key concept 6. And when it comes to the superior laryngeal nerve, again, that's only innervates the cricothyroid muscle via the external branch. Unilateral injury is close to clinically silent, while bilateral injury causes hoarseness or easy tiring of a voice without airway compromise. And that should make sense. You've only knocked out one of the tensors, but you still have abductors and adductors from the recurrent laryngeal. So in contrast, unilateral injury to that recurrent laryngeal nerve causes hoarseness, and bilateral injury can be even worse. If that bilateral injury is acute, you will have unopposed adduction of the vocal cords. We'll talk about this a little bit more later, but if nothing else, you'll have that tensing action of the cricothyroid muscles from the external branch of the superior laryngeal nerve, and that can result in stridor and respiratory compromise. And more chronic bilateral injury to the recurrent laryngeal nerves tends to be a little better tolerated. You have compensatory mechanisms like atrophy of muscles that sort of help that be from being a catastrophe. And then if you injure the vagus bilaterally, so that'll take out your superior laryngeal as well as your recurrent laryngeal, you get flaccid mid-position cords. It'll be hard to talk. You won't be able to phonate, but again, not a lot of airway compromise because the cords don't end up slammed shut due to unopposed tension or adduction. I know that's a lot. I tried to sort of break it down into the least number of things you need to know the innervation from, at least from a testable standpoint. Anything you want to add? Any questions about that section, Ned?
No, I think you summarized it really well. And as you said, this really does come up a lot and is clinically significant. You know, we talk about this, as you said, a lot in neck surgery. So key to know this stuff.
All right. Let's try to apply it and solidify a couple of those points. Question number 4, during a complicated thyroidectomy, the surgeon is concerned that they completely severed the right recurrent laryngeal nerve. Following emergence and extubation of a patient, they perform nasolaryngoscopy, which confirms this suspicion. On examination, they most likely saw A, the left vocal cord fixed in the median position, B, normal function of the vocal cords, or C, the right vocal cord fixed in the paramedian position.
And as you went over, the answer here is going to be C. So you've cut the recurrent laryngeal nerve. You're left just with the superior laryngeal nerve. And so you'll have that tensor and you'll be fixed in that paramedian position.
That's right. And there's no crossing of fibers here. So everything's ipsilateral when it comes to these injuries. And just remember that that recurrent laryngeal nerve innervates muscles at both abduct, that's the posterior cricoarytenoids, and adduct, the lateral cricoarytenoids, the vocal cords. If you completely sever it, the ipsilateral cord will be stuck in a paramedian position. The tensor that you mentioned, the cricothyroid muscle, will still pull it towards the middle a little bit, but it's not full adduction like you would see if you only partially injure the recurrent laryngeal nerve and only knock out the adductors. That's the situation where you get full adduction of the ipsilateral cords. Number five, you are performing an awake fiber optic nasal intubation and have injected local anesthetic via the transtracheal approach. This action most likely affects the A, glossopharyngeal nerves, B, recurrent laryngeal nerves, or C, internal branch of the superior laryngeal nerves.
So this gets back to knowing what nerve innervates what area. And so through the transtracheal approach, you're getting below the cords and up onto the cords. And so, as we discussed before, that's the recurrent laryngeal nerve territory. Now, it's a little tricky because, you know, it's not like you're going in and actually injecting all around the recurrent laryngeal nerve. So what you're doing is getting the kind of very most distal branches of the nerve that actually come to the surface of those areas, but it is the territory of the recurrent laryngeal nerve. So whether you see it listed as the nerve itself or the territory of the recurrent laryngeal nerve, that is the answer there.
I think that's a really good point. There's some action of a recurrent laryngeal nerves you're probably not hitting with this. Number six, the external branch of the superior laryngeal nerve innervates which of the following muscles? A, cricothyroid muscles, B, the posterior cricoretinoid muscles, or C, the lateral cricoretinoid muscles.
And as you went over so well, Tim, it is the cricothyroid muscles that are innervated by the superior laryngeal nerve.
And I have to say, it kind of bothers me that I had to put this question here because it's just a rote memorization, do you know it? But again, I almost guarantee you will see this question on your exam at some point during your board certification. Number seven, at what level is the cricoid cartilage in adults? A, C2, B, C6, or C, T1?
Yep, and just you know it or you don't, and it is C6.
Yep, and we'll get back to that a little bit later as well. So why don't we continue to move further down the respiratory tract a little bit? The trachea comes up next. That's below the larynx. And depending on which textbook you read, the larynx is either part of the upper airway, part of the lower airway, or is the division point. So we're getting into the lower airway now. The trachea is a 10 to 13 centimeter structure. It extends from the lower border of the cricoid cartilage to the carina, where it splits into the right and left main stem bronchi. That occurs at the level of the sternal angle. Remember that the right main stem is more parallel with the trachea than the left main stem. That explains why you get more aspiration and things like that into the right than the left. After the right upper lobe takeoff, the bronchus intermedius splits into the right, middle, and lower lobes, while the left bronchus is slightly longer than the right side and divides directly into the left upper and lower lobes. And sometimes you'll see some aberrant anatomy where that right upper lobe comes right off the trachea as well, but that's not something I've seen tested directly. The bronchial tree then just continues to divide like that. A total of 23 times, it keeps splitting into two at each division, of each generation getting smaller in diameter, larger in number, less cartilaginous, and then each generation eventually ends in alveoli after the 23 divisions. So to summarize that, key concept seven is that the tracheobronchial tree is a conducting airway that serves to both allow for ventilation as well as for clearance of secretions. The right mainstem bronchus, which originates from the sternal angle, is more parallel to the trachea. And as the airways become smaller, their number becomes exponentially greater. That was a lot of talking on my end. I want to pause here for a second. Anything you want to add to that before we wrap up muscles and do some questions?
No, I mean, I think this will come up. But, you know, as you get more and more distal airways, those are all operating in parallel. And so you have this huge amount, even though each one is very small, you actually have this huge amount of surface area and of tube diameter, right? It's small. Each one is small, but because they're in parallel, the air can pass quite easily, assuming they're patent, because there's so many. And it's like pushing through, instead of one tube, you're pushing through an enormous number of tubes all at the same time.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, the thing you're stressing there is that it's an exponential increase in the number of airways in parallel. And that has an important factor.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks, if you've ever been listening to a patient's heart and lungs in pre-op and wondering if there's some mild wheezing or a faint murmur, you are not alone. I used to struggle with this all the time until I got my echo. Honestly, listening through the echo is like night and day compared to a regular stethoscope. That's because Echo's digital stethoscope amplifies heart and lung sounds up to 40 times, and there's noise cancellation to cut out distractions. I can't emphasize enough how amazing it is when you can hear so clearly. The other day, I heard a murmur that my colleague with a regular stethoscope just couldn't hear. And you can unlock murmur and AFib detection powered by Echo AI along with sound recording and sharing for earlier diagnosis. Echo is backed by 4 million heart sounds and 8 FDA clearances for devices and AI algorithms. Those who use it are 2 times more likely to detect heart disease. I can't tell you how much better I can hear hearts and lungs in every area with my Echo. I trust Echo so much that I worked with their team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/ACRAC. Your purchase is HSA and FSA eligible and may qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you'll detect heart sounds and lung conditions more confidently. If you don't, return it for a full refund. Go to echohealth.com/ACCRAC for $50 off plus a free chest piece cover. That's EKOhealth.com/ACCRAC. Hey, folks, I want to dive deeper into something that I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers. FIGS scrubs, made for awesome humans. These are scrubs that have our needs in mind. They're durable, antimicrobial, and super comfortable, which matters when you're 10 hours into your shift. I love my FIGS, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves hers so much that it's all she wears to work. Ever since COVID, she's all FIGS all the time. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, an anesthesiologist like me, or even a med student starting out. Investing in a couple pairs of FIGS is totally worth it. We're partnering with FIGS to get you 15% off your first purchase when you use code FIGSRX at wearfigs.com. FIGS goes beyond scrubs, too. They've got shoes, underscrubs, and even jackets that will make the ever-present hospital AC seem like a thing of the past. And they come in a wide range of colors that will let your personality shine through. Try FIGS today by going to wearfigs.com and get 15% off your first order when you enter code FIGSRX at checkout. Hey, ACRACers. We are thrilled to have as a returning sponsor the one and only TrueLearn Smart Banks. I've used TrueLearn for my residents for years, and it is hands down the best smart bank out there. The questions are excellent, and the answers have clear explanations that break down why each choice is correct or incorrect. I love that it's customizable, so you can target weak areas or take a longer or shorter practice exam anytime. Their metrics are great, and their mobile app lets you study on the go. We use their ITE, basic, and advanced smart banks for our residents, each with 1,000-plus questions, realistic visuals and graphs, and even a calculator that mimics what you have on the exam. Our residents love it and get great results. TrueLearn even has a CME Smart Bank where you can get AMA, PRA, Category 1 credits after you finish training, and an adult cardiac anesthesiology Smart Bank as well. And now they have a fabulous flashcard product, which you can check out, and I highly recommend it. Go to TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAC to get $25 off residency exams, USMLE, and Comlex Smart Bank subscriptions of 90 days or longer, and up to 20% off other healthcare exam subscriptions. We rely on TrueLearn for our test prep, and I recommend you do the same. TrueLearn.com and use code ACCRAC. Hey, folks, between busy schedules and summer plans, if you're like me, you barely have a few free minutes and you want to be outside enjoying the weather, not stuck inside shopping and cooking. Factor solves that for you with their chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals that are ready in just 2 minutes, taking the hassle out of eating well. My kids think Factor tastes like restaurant food, and it really does. Even my two younger daughters, who are very picky eaters, are loving every meal we get from Factor. Some favorites are the chicken tikka masala and premium proteins like salmon and shrimp that come at no extra cost. And with 65 different meal options, you've got GLP-1 friendly meals packed with protein and healthy fats and savory global flavors like the new Asian-inspired meals influenced by China, Thailand, and more. Honestly, I'd still eat them for the convenience even if they weren't so delicious, but the amazing thing is that it's super fast and incredibly tasty. I wouldn't have believed it until I tried it. Get Factor if you want all the flavor and none of the fuss. Get started at factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF and use code ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off your first box plus free breakfast for a year. That's code ACCRAC50OFF at factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off plus free breakfast for an entire year. All right, and we're back.
So moving on to the muscles of a respiratory system, we can start with inspiration. That's driven by upward and outward movement of the ribs and the contraction of the diaphragm being the principal inspiratory muscle by far. It accounts for about 75% of the increase in chest volume and inspiration. The remaining 25 comes largely from the external intercostals. And again, those are pulling the ribs up and forward. And then if you have any kind of increased work of breathing, whether it's exercise, whether it's pathologic, you'll potentially bring in the accessory muscles. There are numerous, I won't list them all, but scalene muscles elevate their sternocleidomastoid and keep the upper ribs from getting pulled down. The ali nasi, flare of the nares, and arguably you could stake all the pharyngeal muscles, the genioglossus, which we mentioned earlier, the retinoids, in here as well, since they maintain upper airway patency, which you need to ventilate. Expiration, on the other hand, doesn't require musculature and is passive, especially when you're supine. But with efforts such as exercise, you need to reverse that upward and outward ribcage movement to bring the ribs down and in, so the abdominal muscles and the internal intercostals can help you expire with increased effort. So key concept 8, inspiration is an active process that relies most heavily on the diaphragm with small contribution from the accessory inspiratory muscles. And expiration is largely passive process, but can be aided by recruitment of the abdominal muscles with increased effort. And to wrap up this section, I want to bring in some of the things that are different between adults and infants. And in the actual outline in this section, the ABA just wants us to know the differences in the larynx between infants and adults. But I see some other things that are tested as well in the pediatric airway, so I figured I'd put them all here. So key concept 9, in comparison to the adult, the infant has a more prominent occiput, a larger tongue, a more cephalad larynx around C2, C3 rather than C5, C6. That you answered correctly earlier. Softer, more omega-shaped epiglottis, softer cartilage, less developed lower airways, which are smaller as a result, and a more caudate, narrowest portion, typically thought of as or tested as subglottic around the cricoid ring versus the glottic opening in adults. Anything to add there, Jed?
No, as you said, typically tested. I think there's some, you know, question about whether or not that's truly accurate. I wonder if we'll start seeing that tested less. I think it's important to know because tests tend to lag behind kind of new findings. But we'll talk about that more. I think we have a question on it. But just keep in mind that whether the infant airway is really different in terms of its narrowest area, that is still, or I should say it was considered settled fact and now maybe is a little up for grabs.
Yeah, that's a good point. You'll see that tested. I think it doesn't come up in that question. I think I removed it because I wanted to avoid this confusion. In the past and older question banks, you'll just see this. It's the narrowest portion is the glottis in adults, and it's absolutely subglottic in pediatrics. And then some in vivo experiments came out, CT imaging, that said maybe that's not true. And then there's the question of, well, is that because these are patients that are anesthetized, and is that different than when you're not anesthetized? So I think they'll slowly stop testing it because we're not as sure that that's true. But if you see it, adults glottis, pediatrics below glottis.
Great.
Or at least infants. All right, let's try some questions. Number 8, a 70-kilogram male is scheduled for an elective cholecystectomy. His anatomic dead space is most likely A, 70 mLs, B, 210 mLs, or C, 140 mLs?
So what you want here is 2 mLs per kilo is what anatomic dead space is going to be most likely, and that gives you answer choice C. However, you may notice that if you look this up, it really should be 2 mLs per kilo of ideal body weight. And so if this is all they give you, for sure, you got to go with answer choice C. They might, though, give you the height and ask you if that's important, and it is. So the anatomic dead space is ideal body weight, and the two things that you need to calculate ideal body weight are gender and height. You actually don't need the actual body weight. And so if you get that information, go with ideal body weight, 2 mLs per kilo of ideal body weight. But here, since they didn't give it to us, the best we can do is assume 70 kilos is the ideal body weight and say answer choice C, 140.
Absolutely. And as a reminder, the anatomic dead space here are just all of the conducting airways that are not involved in gas exchange. Question 9, you're working with a curious resident who is solidifying their knowledge of Poiseuille's law and inquires which part of respiratory tract has the least resistance. You respond that it is A, the medium-sized bronchi, B, the small bronchi, or C, the trachea.
Yeah, so this is really interesting because this is kind of what we were talking about before. If you are talking about any individual airway, it's clearly the trachea because the larger the diameter, the less the resistance. But if you take all the small bronchi together, then that's actually going to have altogether a lot more diameter because those are in parallel. If they were in series, it wouldn't matter. But because they're in parallel, they act like they're all one giant airway in terms of the resistance. And so that's going to be your answer here is the small bronchi. And the reason it's not the medium-sized bronchi is just because, again, you haven't branched off and gotten even more. So the more you have in parallel, the more the less the resistance is going to be.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's sort of the medium-sized bronchi, if you see the opposite question of where the most resistance is, it is at that level of medium-sized bronchi because you've gotten smaller, but you haven't gotten so many in number yet that you overcome that effect of individual increased resistance of the smaller airways. Question 10, you return to the PACU to reassess a 32-year-old female with a past medical history significant for asthma. She had developed increased work of breathing postoperatively, concerning for an asthma exacerbation, and was treated appropriately. She now appears to be breathing comfortably, reclined in bed on room air. Which muscle is she least likely to be using at this time? A, internal intercostals, B, external intercostals, or C, arytenoids?
Well, hopefully right off the bat, we can identify that the arytenoids are not a muscle. So hopefully we can get rid of that. And if you don't know anything else, that leaves you only two. But as you said up front, Tim, internal intercostals, if used, are used in kind of forcible exhalation. And so if you are now breathing comfortably, you should be fine not using those at all. External intercostals, you can use as accessory muscles. And so, again, maybe not as likely, but if this is someone who had an asthma exacerbation and she may still be using them a little bit, but certainly the internal intercostals are the best answer in the sense that you would never be using them for inspiration.
Completely agree. And then our last question here for anatomy, which of the following characteristics is more representative of an adult rather than an infant airway? A, the larynx is located at about C5, C6. B, the epiglottis is omega-shaped. And C, the airway, small airway cartilaginous rings are softer.
Yeah, so this is the one where traditionally you probably would have seen a reference to the infant airway being narrowest down around the cricoid cartilage. But as we discussed, we took that out because a little unsure whether that's still going to be tested. But here, it is going to be answer choice A, the larynx is located in adults at about C5, C6. And then the other two are going to refer to infants. So the infant epiglottis is more omega-shaped, and in the infant, small airway rings are softer.
Perfect. Okay, so let's move on to respiratory pharmacology. We've done the bulk of the work here. The anatomy, I think, has more information in it. The anatomy is more tested. But let's knock off pharmacology as well. They want us to know, one, bronchodilators, and that's beta agonists and anticholinergics as far as they're concerned, and then two anti-inflammatory medications, steroid leukotriene modifier drugs, mast cell stabilizers, and immunoglobulin E blockers. I'll knock this out in three key concepts. Key concept one is that stimulation of the parasympathetic nervous system causes airway smooth muscle constriction. That's via acetylcholine on M2 and M3 receptors. And there are also neurohormonal agents that cause constriction, including but not limited to histamine, acetylcholine, thromboxane A2, serotonin, prostacycline, leukotrienes. Key concept two. The beta agonists act as bronchodilators by increasing the concentration of cyclic AMP. The quick pathway without getting into too much pharmacology is beta 2 receptor, GS, G protein, S activation, increased CMP, PKA, which has a couple of different effects that result in smooth muscle relaxation. In contrast, the anticholinergics act as bronchodilators secondary to inhibiting the cholinergic M3 receptors, thus blunting that parasympathetic constrictive drive we just mentioned. And then key concept three, inhaled or systemic steroids, the leukotriene modifier drugs, the one I see most in tests is montelukast. The mast cell stabilizers, again, the one I see most on tests is cromolyn. And IgE blockers are all beneficial to maintaining airway patency and reducing airway reactivity by reducing the action of those neurohormonal agents I mentioned earlier that can cause smooth muscle constriction. So, for instance, cromolyn reduces the release of histamine from mast cells. Montelukast reduces the amount of leukotriene-mediated constriction and mucus production. Those are just sort of the broad strokes to know with those medications.
Great.
Question one. Which of the following neurohormonal factors has the least effect on increasing airway resistance? A, thromboxane A2, B, histamine, or C, CAMP, or CAMP?
And so as we just went over, thromboxane and histamine both can cause bronchoconstriction, but cyclic AMP is part of a pathway that leads to smooth muscle relaxation and air bronchodilation. So the answer will be C, since that actually causes bronchodilation and not constriction.
Perfect. Number two, a 76-year-old female is presenting for a transcatheter aortic valve replacement. She has a history of COPD, which is treated with ipratropium. The benefit of this medication in COPD is most likely A, competitive inhibition of cholinergic M3 receptors, B, non-competitive inhibition of cholinergic M3 receptors, or C, activation of cholinergic M3 receptors.
So hopefully you know at least you can get rid of C, because activation of cholinergic M3 receptors would cause bronchoconstriction. And so you're left with A and B, and this is just something you have to know, that it's a competitive inhibition. And so the answer is A.
Perfect. Number three, following an uneventful induction and intubation of a healthy 26-year-old patient, you see a sawtooth pattern on end-tidal capnography. Assuming this is secondary to bronchospasm, you treat the patient with albuterol. Which of the following is a likely side effect from this medication? B, inaccuracy of pulse oximetry, B, hyperkalemia, or C, tachycardia.
And this, again, if you've used it, you know that albuterol, beta agonist, or you just know the mechanism, beta agonist can cause tachycardia. And that's going to be the answer here. B is wrong because it's hypokalemia. And that is important to know. You could get tested on that albuterol can cause hypokalemia, and there's no reason to think that there'd be inaccuracy of the pulse ox.
That's right. I'm not sure if that's getting at things you'd see like with methylene blue or other things that could actually cause failure of a probe to read an appropriate signal. The thing sometimes you'll see it, I've never seen this tested, but I always love seeing it on machines. When you mix albuterol with any of a volatile agent, sometimes you'll confuse the ventilator and you'll get it to start showing volatile compounds that we don't even have in supply. Enflurane, halothane, everything will show up.
Yeah, that's always fun.
Okay. Number four, and our last question for the day, a 49-year-old male with past medical history of hypertension, asthma, and kidney stones underwent an uncomplicated laser lithotripsy. In the PACU, he was hypertensive and a medication was administered to treat this. He subsequently recorded subjective shortness of breath and wheezing. Which of the following medications did he most likely receive? A, a beta blocker, B, an arterial vasodilator, or C, a prodrug that releases nitric oxide?
So the key here is that he has asthma, and now he's short of breath and wheezing. So what can trigger asthma? And we're always taught, hopefully this is something you know, that a beta blocker is something you need to be cautious of in asthmatics. There's no reason that an arterial vasodilator would do that, and something that releases nitric oxide, same thing. So a beta blocker, there are, of course, selective and non-selective beta blockers. Any of them still can, even if it's selective, it's not 100% selective. And so even the selective ones like atenolol and metoprolol, you still have to be cautious in people with asthma and COPD. Not absolutely contraindicated, but you just need to be cautious and be aware that that could be a side effect, especially if they're not already on it at home. And then certainly you want to avoid the non-selective ones, which are the ones that are further down in the alphabet, like pindolol.
Perfect. Anything else about pharmacology or back to anatomy that you think we should touch on?
I think you covered it well, Tim. Should we move to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations?
Let's do it.
All right. What do you have for the audience to check out?
So it's a recommendation that I gave you a little bit ago, and I hear you just started reading this series. It's called Solo Leveling. It's a South Korean portal fantasy web novel. It's available in a few different formats. I haven't read the comic or anything, but it's, I think, in 7 volumes that you can read it. It's also available in audiobook. And basically, there's a world where there are people that hunt monsters that come through these gates to keep people safe. And then one of them finds that he can get a little bit more powerful than the others. And it's a 7-volume novel of how he keeps getting more powerful. Although sometimes I almost felt like it was going to get repetitive, I was ultimately glued the whole time and got through all 7 novels. I don't know, probably in a couple of weeks, or pretty short.
Yeah, I appreciate the recommendation. I will add to that that I started the first book, and, you know, for the first, I don't know, you know, maybe I read it on Kindle, so there aren't real pages, but I would guess for the first, you know, section, maybe the first 10-15% of the first book, I was skeptical. I was like, I almost put it down and just moved on. And I was going to say to you, Tim, like, what were you thinking recommending this? But then it starts to get interesting. So now I'm about a third of the way through the first book, and I'm now pretty interested. So I'll weigh back in once I've finished at least one complete book. But I do think if you want to try these books, make sure you don't quit after the first chunk, because it does get a lot better. And the first, it's really kind of an intro. You just have to get through that first part.
Yeah.
I'm going to recommend another book called The Frozen River by Ariel Lawhon. I may be pronouncing her name wrong, but it's Lawhon. Really interesting book, historical novel set back around the time, around the 1750s or so, in Maine, and really well written, very poignant, powerful, interesting, and it's in many ways like a murder mystery, and really captivating. So fun read, really well done. Recommend it. All right, Tim, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks so much. See you next time.
See you next time.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrack.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at Acrack Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrack. That's patreon.com/accrack, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrack. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew.
Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Taylor Duggan is our social media manager. And William Mao is our production assistant. Thanks so much for all you do.
Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. You bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.